The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 92.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to bring someone to the Rebel Capitalist Show that I've really looked forward to talking to. His name is Ronnie Stufferle, and I'm sure I'm butchering that, Ronnie. I apologize, but he is one of the editors of the Mega Gold Report in Gold We Trust. It comes out once a year, 350 pages. It is the go-to guide. Ronnie, welcome to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hi, Josh. Thanks for having me. And you almost got it right, Stufferle.
Okay.
It's a tough one.
Hopefully
it's
we
a
can
tough
edit
one.
That back in. I apologize. But for my viewers who might not know your full backstory, can you get us up to speed there?
Sure. Well, I'm managing partner and fund manager at Incrementum, which is a wealth manager based in Liechtenstein. I am, perhaps you heard my kind of weird accent, I'm originally from Austria, from Vienna. So most people would think, okay, this is where the Austrian School of Economics is taught. Right. No, it is not. I kind of rediscovered and found out about the Austrian school through the great financial crisis when I was an analyst sitting in a bank, and then I've heard about Ludwig von Mises, and I thought, who's that? Yeah, and who's Hayek and who is Karl Menger? So at some point, you know, sitting in the bank, I realized it's a bit like, the vegetarian sitting in the butchery. Because I started writing about gold in 2007, and I thought, you know, that's so fascinating. It's not about gold, it's about everything. So I discovered the Austrian school, and at some point I said, okay, I have to quit my job in the bank, set up my own company. And I did that with fantastic colleagues from Switzerland and from Austria, and we set up Incrementum. And I continued writing the In Gold We Trust report, which is now really one of the most widely followed publications on gold. As you've said, it's quite a brick. It's 350 pages. The compact version is even 100 pages. But it is it is my contribution to, let's say, financial literacy, to educating and informing people about sound money and what central bank policy do to you and your hard-earned money. So it is really, for us, it's really a very important publication, and I'm glad that people from all over the world really love this publication, and it makes us a little bit proud. But it's also something, you know, where we really distill all the thoughts that we have through conversations that we have with clients, with institutional managers, with people at conferences. The stuff that we're reading in books, that we're reading in newsletters, we try to distill it and once a year publish this big report. So it is a heavy reading, but I think I hope it's worth taking the time.
Oh, it absolutely is. And I want to be clear, there's a lot of macro in there as well. It's not just gold, silver, precious metals. I mean, it's everything you can imagine. It's money supply, inflation, deflation, the reserve currency. I mean, it really dives into a lot of topics above and beyond just precious metals. Of course, they all tie in, but it's really a well-rounded report for sure. So on that note, what are some of your macro views right now? We're living in crazy, crazy times, to say the least. I just on Twitter the last couple of days, and on, I think, Real Vision last night, I listened to their daily update, and they were talking about a lot of these people using their unemployment checks to go into the stock market and literally buy stock of companies who have already filed bankruptcy. And I don't see that happening at the beginning of a brand new bull market. What do you think, Ronnie?
Well, I've read that as well, and I did some research on that. And it is interesting, in April, personal income rose a record 10.5%, which is 2 trillion, in the same month when actually 20 million jobs got lost. So
in the United States?
In the United States, yeah. Wow. So government doled out 3 trillion in handouts in the form of income transfers of all kinds at an annualized rate. So over half of the people are receiving more in benefits than they received before when they had a job. So, of course, this is some sort of generosity on steroids. And we can see that for Robinhood, for example, this online brokerage, they had 3 million new account openings since the corona crisis started. Now, people are getting, you know, all the money basically transferred from the government. There's, you know, nothing on Netflix anymore that they haven't seen. There's no sports they can watch. So what do? They invest or they gamble. And I think this is really one of the main triggers because, you know, there are stocks like Hertz, for example, the rental car company that used to be really big. I mean, it went bankrupt and now its stock is trading at even a higher level than before they declared bankruptcy. Yeah? Then there's other companies. What is it called? Is it Nikola? Something like it
sounds... Oh, yes, I heard about that. Yeah, tell that story. That was incredible. Yes, I just heard about that.
It sounds a bit similar like Tesla. I think Nikola or something like that. So they're in the process of producing electric-driven trucks. Of course, they've got no turnover whatsoever. I did some research on it and I thought, you know, it is crap. But their market cap is like 27 billion, which is more than Ford at the moment. So you can tell there's quite a lot of new speculative frenzy in stock markets. And that's obviously not a very healthy sign. I mean, it is mainly driven, I always said it's not a V-shaped recovery, it's an L-shaped recovery, and L stands for liquidity, because those amounts that are pumped into the economy by central banks, they're just staggering.
Yeah, you know, and just to be clear, the company you're talking about, the guy, when they went public, stated that it was just basically a play to get retail investors involved. Their market cap is almost 30 billion, and for the 2021, they project zero revenue. So not zero profit. They project zero revenue. So the 12-year-old boy who's getting a $2 allowance per week is going to make more, or get more revenue in 2021. But their value, their market cap is $30 billion. And it's just so obvious to me that it's all these, I'm not going to call them kids, but just all these people who think they got in late with Tesla and like, oh my gosh, now it's 700, it's 800, it's 900. Oh, I wish I would have bought it at 50. I wish I would have bought it at 10. I wish I would have done this, you know, woulda, shoulda, coulda, this FOMO. And so they're seeing this company. Well, it's got the same name. So it's got to be just as good. So I'm going to buy in here at the bottom level, and I'm going to ride it all the way up to $1,000 a share, and I'm going to get rich just like I should have with Tesla. But unfortunately, it never seems to be that easy.
No, I mean, what's going on at the moment? It's clearly super interesting, George. You know, I was back at home with the family when everything started. So I was basically working from home most of the time, which was, you know, it was demanding because my wife is working in the oil and gas industry, which had a quite tough time the last couple of weeks. And I was really writing my diary basically every day, and I tried to note down all the measures that were taken by central bankers. And at the moment, it is roughly of 20% of world GDP were injected by monetary stimulus and fiscal stimulus. And I think if we make the comparison 2008 versus the current crisis. I think the big difference is, first of all, that the numbers coming out of central banks, they acted much more aggressively. Let's not forget that the Federal Reserve did this emergency meeting, I think on a Sunday. They basically said that they lower down to zero. And this was the emperor has no clothes moment, because I think futures for the S&P were limit down, actually. So it showed me that the market has kind of lost trust in the Federal Reserve in that moment. And those measures that were taken were much bigger in size and they were much more coordinated. But this time around, it was also fiscal policy that was really, really aggressive. And I think this combination of monetary and fiscal stimulus will lead us to, this reflation much quicker. And it's telling me that basically, if we compare it to 2008, 2009, I think back then, US 10-year treasuries were trading at 3.5%. Now they are way below. You know, who would have expected that $14 trillion US dollar are sitting in bonds with negative yields? I mean, right. $14 trillion US dollars. So investors are taking a guaranteed loss holding them to maturity. So it is obvious that central bankers are basically running out of ammunition. And this is why I thought it was really, really interesting when Jay Powell said on 60 Minutes just recently, he said, there's really no limit to what we can do with these lending programs. So he was extremely dovish. So from my point of view, I don't think that the economy is really in a V-shaped recovery. I think it will take much, much longer than most people expect. I think for now the health crisis is over, but the next crisis will be a credit crisis, will be a debt crisis, will be perhaps a financial crisis. Because, you know, those problems sitting on bank balance sheets, at some point they will pop up. So we shouldn't underestimate the creativity and the aggressiveness of central bankers, but also fiscal policy. And I said recently, what we should expect, stuff like MMT, somebody called it Mugabe Maduro theory, helicopter money, universal basic income, all that stuff that used to be like the a wet dream of some monetarist economist sitting in the ivory towers.
Right.
But now this is basically a given that it's going to happen. And people just accustomed to that and say, the government will take care of everything. And this is something that I really want to stress out all the time. It is... this crisis will not be solved with more capitalism, with more free markets. It will be solved with more interventionism and more socialism. And this is something that worries me quite a lot.
Well, they'll try to solve it with more. Yeah. I think it would be solved with capitalism. They're going to try to solve it with the antithesis of that. Yeah, I want to go back. You made some fantastic points, Ronnie. And back in March, I was really watching the markets closely for obvious reasons. And I remember specifically when the Fed came out on that Sunday, they were supposed to meet the next Wednesday. Mm-hmm. And they had this emergency meeting where they dropped rates. You're right, the market just fell out of bed the next day. But what happened, the catalyst seemed to be, from a timing standpoint, is when the government came in and started announcing all of these fiscal measures, all these stimulus packages. That's when the market actually started to go back up. When the Fed was just throwing everything at it and the kitchen sink, when they're committing to $1 trillion a day in repo. And again, not that they did that, but they're committing to $1 trillion a day in repo. They were doing QE unlimited. The market was just shrugging it off, saying, you know, we don't care. And so it seemed to be that maybe there's no longer a Fed put, there's a fiscal put, but how long can that go? And we know, you and I, just understanding how bank reserves are created and central banks work and M1 and M2, base money, broad money, we know that if there's a fiscal put, that it's most likely going to be a lot more inflationary when you look at consumer goods and services than the Fed just expanding their balance sheet by printing up bank reserves. So that stated, I'd love to get your take on deflation and inflation. You talked about that in a recent video, and you had some fantastic insights to consumer inflation in the United States, especially around groceries and food prices. So can you go into that?
Yeah, sure. Well, the question of inflation and deflation, that's actually for our investment process, that's really crucial. Yeah? Because when one of our funds, we invest in inflation-sensitive assets. Now, what's most inflation-sensitive? It is, of course, gold. It is silver, it is commodities in general, it is mining stocks, gold and silver stocks, of course. It is commodity currencies like the ruble, like the Australian dollar, like the Canadian dollar. Of course, inflation-linked bonds are interesting. So for us, it was really crucial to understand this interplay between inflation and deflation. And we coined the term monetary tectonics. So it's basically tectonic plates pushing against each other and creating pressure. And we always said, you know, if there would be a laissez-faire approach, which would be, you know, the capitalist, the Austrian solution, it would be highly deflationary. We would see a recession. We would see massive unemployment, but we would see afterwards a stronger capital structure. But actually, the central bank policy wants basically to make up for this natural deflation by introducing quantitative easing, by, you know, forcing bank lending and so on. And on the surface, this turned out pretty well because everybody said, you know, Ronnie, everybody's talking about all you Austrian economists talked about inflation, about hyperinflation, but where is it? Nothing happened. And then I first say, you know, your inflation definition is a different one to mine. From my point of view, inflation means an increase in the money supply.
In base money or broad money?
I mean, this is something that we almost wrote a book about, Austrian School for Investors, Austrian Investing Between Inflation and Deflation. It is, I think, that the broad money supply actually didn't grow fast enough. And this was probably the main reason why we didn't see any, you know, in German we would say Teuerung. In English it would be basically price inflation. And of course there's people like Jeff Snyder, but also our mutual friend Emil Kalinowski, who really dig into this topic, and I think it's highly fascinating. Now, 2008, 2009, many people always also only had a look at balance sheets, and they saw, okay, it's exploding, so actually this must be hyperinflationary. And we said, you know, most of the monetary aggregates are actually created, of course, by commercial banks.
Right.
Now, what we saw over the last 10 years was massive asset price inflation, of course. And this is, of course, something that the Federal Reserve wants to create because you say, you know, the wealth effect works. And we saw massive asset price inflation in equities. We saw it in real estate all over the globe. We saw it in the art market and, of course, in the bond market. Now, according to Murray Rothbard, and this is really a fascinating book, The Mystery of Banking, he says the third stage only is price inflation. And this is the moment when actually central bankers should become more hawkish, more conservative again, when people kind of lose trust in paper money, in the purchasing power that they have in the US dollars, in the euros, whatever, and they just start spending it, they start up buying real assets. And Mises described that as in German it's called Katastrophenhaus, which is a fantastic term. In English it would be the crack-up boom. Mm. Now, I think that we're perhaps in the beginning of such a crack-up boom, because as I've said before, this time around it is much more direct interventionism into these inflationary policies. This time around, you know, MMT or helicopter money and so on have a much more direct input and consequence on spending behaviors and on economic numbers and inflation than traditional quantitative easing. Now, what we saw, and which is a bit our case for rising inflation, and I don't want to say that inflation is really around the corner, but I see it on the horizon. I think that, first of all, at some point, central bankers will kind of underestimate the time lag. So there will be a point when consumers regain confidence, and then actually they would have to become, so central banks and fiscal policy would have to become more conservative again. I think they will miss this point. They will be too dovish for too long. They always do. Then the second thing is, we're seeing this big trend to deglobalization, yeah? And I'm a free market guy from my point of view. Free market is something fantastic. It helps everybody. It makes goods better and cheaper. It is, also important for peace, because, countries that trade with each other usually don't fight wars. So this trend to deglobalization is something that worries me and definitely has an inflationary impact. Then we're seeing a reduced productivity, which is also inflationary, because in all the factories that you're seeing now, you've got these very strict requirements, which just reduces productivity. And then I would say, just from the motivation, we're seeing debt levels now for industrialized nations that we used to have only for banana republics. Now, of course, the higher your debt level as a government, as a household, as a corporation, the higher your fear of deflation, and the more you wish for inflation.
Right.
And of course, as the whole system is highly over indebted, deflation, this natural deflation, is just the biggest enemy of the system. And therefore, there will be massive inflationary policies. We're already seeing that. Inflation expectations this time around, they rebounded much quicker than in 2008, 2009. And we have never seen this deflationary mindset in this crisis, because the reactions have been so much more aggressive. So in a nutshell, I think that inflation might become a real concern, and actually something that mainstream economists think is impossible. I think that stagflation is something that we should be actually scared of.
Yeah, I completely agree. And you were saying in your report about the food prices at the grocery store that psychologically, that tends to be a catalyst for people worrying about inflation. The more people worry about inflation, the more they want to maybe get rid of their fiat for something else, which kind of has this this positive feedback loop, if you will, that creates even more and more inflation. I'd call it a doom vortex on one of my if we were on one of my whiteboard videos. But can you explain that?
Yeah, we actually, in our report, we've got like 450 footnotes. Yeah, so we really try to link to external sources. We want to tell the people, okay, this is an interesting study. Have a look at this webpage. Have a look at the tweets of those guys. And we actually found some really fascinating work on inflation expectations. And the outcome was that the most important driver for anchoring inflation expectations is actually in supermarkets, when you go grocery shopping. Now, in April, I think we saw the biggest rise in supermarket prices in 40 years. Yeah. So it seems that if people become concerned, okay, well, I'm not paying $100 for my grocery shopping, I'm paying 110, 120, whatever, now, that this will definitely influence their inflation expectations. One thing that is, I think, highly interesting at the moment is, and this reminds me very, very much of the Great Depression, we are seeing at the moment that the savings rate is exploding higher. It jumped from 12.7% to 33%. And this is something that we should have a very, very close look at from my point of view, because this is going to tell us, are people seeing some sort of a long-term depressionary environment, or is it for them more of a, you know, just a quick recession and then everything is back to normal? So I think that
they're buying call options in the S&P. They're buying Nikola. They're buying Hertz. I'm sorry to cut you off there, buddy. It just still boggles my mind. But okay, so do you have anything else to expand on there? Because I think this transitions us into another part of your report where you're talking about the de-dollarization. And this is really fascinating for me because we see the U.S. as obviously the world reserve currency. We know that it allows Americans to consume way more than they otherwise would have, therefore boosting GDP and making the economy look a lot healthier than it may actually be from a fundamental standpoint. And if the world decides that, hey, we really don't want to do business in dollars anymore, you've got, who knows, 20, 30 trillion US dollars outside of the United States that could come back in. And there's no way that you can increase goods and services at the same rate. So that means the dollar goes down and then gold goes way up, and we'll get into gold next. So can you expand on the de-dollarization portion of your most recent report?
Well, we're covering this topic of de-dollarization already for, I think, 5 or 6 years. And we always said this is a really long-term trend. So don't expect the US dollar being, taken out as the world reserve currency, and the Chinese yuan or the euro will take over its role. If you study history, you can see that basically the British pound and the US dollar for more than a decade were basically at the same time the world's leading currencies. And then only after the Second World War, basically, Bretton Woods, the dollar came out as the world reserve currency. And I think one of the main reasons was that the US held 29,000 tons of gold. So actually, this was definitely one of the decisive factors for the US getting this exorbitant privilege, as the French call it. Now, I think this de-dollarization is really something that is kind of picking up momentum. We really show lots of different, you know, tiny pieces that added together clearly show that there is something big going on. Lots of agreements between China and Saudi Arabia, China and Russia, many commodity producing nations kind of circumventing the US dollar and using their local currencies and so on. But it is also, if you understand history, it is also something that is not only being fought on financial markets, it is also something highly political. And we shouldn't forget that the US still has by far the strongest military, which is also quite a big factor, I would say. But George, I don't know if you know, but the first trip from Donald Trump abroad, where did he go to? Do you remember?
I don't know.
He went to Saudi Arabia. And I think this is quite telling, because the Saudis, of course, are their most important alliance when it comes to the the dollar being the reserve currency where everything is traded in. But we have seen over the last couple of years, first of all, this loss of trust that we're seeing in the media, that we're seeing, of course, in economics, that we're seeing in science. Last year, perhaps, for example, we showed that more and more people are believing in the flat earth theory and stuff like that. So people
really?
Are just, people wow. are losing trust in many different things, but it's also in political alliances where, you know, strategic alliances that we had for decades, they are basically broken up. And this tells me that this de-dollarization is kind of picking up momentum. And I think that at some point there will be, as my Swiss partners, they're very diplomatic, they always say, there will be a realignment of international of the international currency system. So
that's a very nice way of saying it. Yeah,
it's very very Swiss. But if you study history, and unfortunately most people don't care about history, but if you study history, you can tell that every couple of decades we saw currency reforms, we saw, you know, new world leading currencies coming up. And this brings me to gold. I think it's no coincidence that the US holds 8,100 tons of gold. The Eurozone holds more than 10,000 tons of gold. The Chinese are buying every ounce they can get. The Russia is having more than 2,000 tons. The IMF has more than 3,000 tons. Turkey is buying gold. So the most important players, like Jim Ricketts recently said, you know, they are coming, the big boys are coming to the table, and their chips, they're basically golden. So if there should be such a realignment of the international currency system, I think that gold will really play a major role.
Oh, absolutely. 100%. So are you in the camp that believes we could see a gold standard in the future? And I know it's not right around the corner, but 10 years, 15 years down the road?
Well, you know, as an economist, I would say, yeah, of course, it would be terrific. And if you study history, you can say that those times of the classical gold standard were pretty a vibrant time. Mm-hmm. You know, if you read, for example, The World of Yesterday, a fantastic book by Stefan Zweig, where he describes this time of the classical gold standard and afterwards the hyperinflation in Austria and in Germany, and what it did to societies and how frustrated people became and how open they became for radical ideas. This reminds me very much of the current mindset, because we can see that, you know, weirdo ideas from the right and weirdo ideas from the left are coming into the center, and populists are winning elections basically all over the globe. So coming back to the gold standard, you know, knowing politicians, I would say this is not something that they really enjoy having, yeah, because a gold standard, of course, it restricts you in your spending, and you should have over time a balanced budget. You cannot just pay for everything, and it would be something that would be a very limiting factor for politicians. But I think at some point when there's a loss of trust in paper money,
right,
then I think we'll need a new basis, and this basis has always been gold. Now, trust, you know, our report is not, it's not a coincidence that it's called In Gold We Trust. And last year we wrote about this trust erosion, and we said that trust is highly asymmetrical. It takes decades, centuries to build up trust, and then in 1 second, basically, you can completely lose trust. Bill Cosby, for example, yeah. I mean, he used to be the good uncle, the good guy, and then all those allegations came up. Lehman Brothers, one of the oldest investment banks, over 100 years, they didn't have one quarter making losses, and then over a couple of weeks, the market lost trust in their balance sheet, in their liquidity, and they were bust. So I think this stage when people lose faith, lose trust in paper money, it can happen pretty quickly. And then, of course, you need something to restore trust. And this will probably be gold again.
This podcast is sponsored by my friends at Capitalist Exploits, one of the few research letters I read myself. If you want more information on how this powerful tool can help you become a better investor, plus get a 15% discount, check out our affiliate link. We'll put it right in the show notes page. Do you think that the U.S. will go to a government-backed digital currency before potentially we go to a gold standard?
You know, If you understand Bitcoin, if you understand cryptocurrencies, I think it's quite frustrating to hear about those how is it called, central bank digital currencies, because you know, they've got nothing to do with the ideas.
Our friend Eric Townsend with Macro Voices calls it the Orwell.
Yeah.
The U.S. digital currency, or potential U.S. digital currency, he calls it the Orwell, rightfully so.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think when in a crisis, politicians tend to become really creative and also kind of proactive. So I wouldn't rule that out. And I wouldn't rule out that we will see much more financial repression. Yield curve control is the new buzzword. I think, like my friend Russell Napier always says, expect much more capital controls. We're already seeing that in Germany, for example. I don't know the exact number, but the amount of millionaires just leaving the country is staggering. And this is not only about their capital, like their financial capital. It's also about their, you know, their entrepreneurial creativity. It's about their network. It's about their work ethics.
So, who is John Galt?
Yeah, exactly. I tweeted it out. I sometimes really feel like an Atlas Shrugged, yeah? And we know how it ends. So this is something that really bugs me. And then we're coming back to more interventionism, less capitalism. And, you know, what kids are getting taught at school, you know, everybody basically cheers for a strong state and less markets. Over here, we've got like 50%. Of GDP is created by the government. So I wonder why people are still speaking about a capitalist system. I just don't see it.
Just out of curiosity, where do you see all of those millionaires or producers actually going in Europe? Are they going, I mean, to Monaco? Or are they going to Croatia, Montenegro? I'm just curious. In a few of my last videos, I've talked about kind of where to bug out regions like the Caribbean and stuff. Do you have any idea?
Well, Switzerland, of course, is the go-to place. Okay. Liechtenstein is also very successful. For young, I shouldn't say young, like my age, but let's say that the younger generation, very talented people with great education, they go to Singapore, they go to Hong Kong, Asia in general. There are lots of great projects. A friend of mine, Titus Gable, is coming up with this free private cities in Honduras, for example. There's, you know, lots of ideas. And of course, this pressure, those capital controls, this financial repression, it also creates new ideas and new businesses. And this is what I'm excited about. But of course, the majority of people will suffer from those policies.
Yeah. Okay, let's take it back to gold. And when I talk in my live streams or on some of my videos, I always try to encourage people, or the advice I give them, that might be a better way of saying it, is just what I do myself and what I try to get my family and friends to do as well. And that's just simply to divide your portfolio into three categories: insurance, investing, which I define as it's got to pay you to own it. And then speculation. The only reason you're buying it is because you think it's cheap right now. It doesn't really pay you to own it. So such as Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. I see gold as insurance, physical gold, 10%. But then I also try to buy things when they're cheap and sell them when they're expensive. I try not to focus on the price. So in your opinion right now, I know you guys are really bullish on gold. I'm right there with you. But why or why not is gold cheap right now? And then taking it to the next level, why are you guys really bullish?
Well, I think that gold, it is not, you're completely right. It's an insurance, or as Grant Williams says, an insurance, because the more unsure you are about the future, the more gold you should have. I think that's great wording. From my point of view, the role of gold is not to make you rich. It is to preserve your purchasing power. This is the job that gold is doing. And I don't know, do you have any favorite sports, George?
Oh boy, yeah, Formula One.
Formula, what about football, soccer?
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Let's do let's do basketball. Sure.
Okay. No, but I said in an interview recently, I compared gold to a defender in your team. It's basically there to, you know, defend to not let the opponent score any goals. This is the job. It's not the job to be, you know, to score all the goals, to be offensive. Right. It is something that keeps you safe, that keeps your purchasing power safe. And you know, we've got lots of comparisons, long-term comparisons in our report. And one of the most often quoted one is our beer to gold ratio, where we show. Yeah, the price.
Oh, I haven't heard this one.
Did you ever go to the Oktoberfest in Munich?
What's that?
The Oktoberfest in Munich.
I've never been, but I'd love to go.
You get those big beers, like 1 liter.
Oh, okay.
And we crunched the numbers, and it's interesting because we've got this very long time series. And since the year 1950, the average price increase every year was 5%. So 1 liter of beer costs 5% more every year. And many people say this is closer to actual inflation as everybody is experiencing it. And then we calculate, you know, your purchasing power of 1 ounce of gold, how many beers you can buy at the Oktoberfest in Munich. And actually, it is not 100% stable. But it's just over the long term, you've got a pretty decent purchasing power. And we did the same with, you know, admission tickets to Disneyland. We did the same with loaves of bread. We did the same with cars and so on, with oil, of course. And it tells you gold really over the long term, it is a good hedge against inflationary policies. And this is all gold has to do. Now, coming back to your question, if it's expensive or not, inflation adjusted, the price of gold would have to go to 2,300 to be above the 1980 all-time high. So inflation adjusted, it is very cheap. If you compare it relative to the equity market or the bond market, gold is cheap. If you compare it to oil, for example, gold is pretty expensive at the moment. Mm-hmm. Now, from our point of view, if we measure it in monetary terms, because it doesn't make any sense, like Warren Buffett does, to compare equities to gold. This is like, you know, comparing a Formula One driver, you know, Ayrton Senna, Niki Lauda, to a basketball player. It doesn't make any sense, yeah? But if you compare gold to the US dollar, to the euro, to the Canadian dollar, whatever, this makes sense. And in monetary terms, because so much money was created over the last couple of years, I think gold is still pretty cheap. And from a technical point of view, gold is trading now in an uptrend. So it's showing relative strength against the equity market. It is showing relative strength against the bond market. And gold is up in every currency. In fact, it is trading at or close to all-time highs in every currency but the US dollar. So from our point of view, it will hit new all-time highs in US dollars as well. We've got a proprietary model that we explain in the report where we see at the end of this decade, gold might go to $4,800 or even higher. Now, that sounds like a large number, but it is actually a compound annual growth rate of 10.9%, which then would say, okay, it's actually not that bad. And we expect some sort of a stagflationary decade. So in stagflation, you're having a really hard time on the bond market, of course. You're having a hard time with many, many sectors in the equity markets. You should be very, very selective when it comes to real estate. And gold does extremely well if such a stagflationary environment should play out. But it is gold for me, it is not a religion. It is not something to go crazy about. But it is a proper insurance that everybody should own. That's basically it.
Is that price target nominal?
It is nominal, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
But then it means probably a beer or a coffee will also be significantly higher, but your purchasing power measured in gold will be pretty stable.
One thing I've been trying to figure out, because I know there's a lot of confusion, even from so-called experts, are gold coins subject to capital gains tax if you, and I know it might be different in the UK and different in the United States. Do you have any idea on what's accurate there?
Well, thank God I'm not a tax advisor. and, you know, I cannot give an answer for every country. But over here in Austria, for example, and in many, many countries in the European Union, if you hold it longer than 1 year, you don't have to pay any capital gains tax. So if I buy this coin today and I sell it in 1 year and it's up 20%, I don't have to pay anything on that. Okay. Yeah. If I sell it in 2 months, then I have to pay capital gains tax on the profit. Okay. So
and
this
for,
is definitely
for the American viewers. I want to be clear. It could be, and I think it might be, drastically different in the United States.
Yes.
So make sure that you're doing a lot of homework. And I know on my comment stream, I always get people saying, well, George, if you go down to the local pawn shop or the gold shop, it's not reportable. But just because the pawn shop is telling you it's not reportable, that just means that they don't have to report it. It doesn't necessarily mean that you don't have to report it on your own personal tax return. So there could be some discrepancy there, but that's great insight. Okay, so I don't want to spend too much time on that because I know the viewers won't be overly concerned with that. But can you explain the gold-silver ratio? And when you look at that through history, is it something that we should put a lot of weight into? And if so, what is it telling us right now?
Yeah, I mean, we had a special chapter on silver in this year's gold report. And our friend Emil Kalinowski, he helped us on that. And I think it's really fascinating to see that, you know, 2 years ago, I was kind of ridiculed at every keynote that I gave when I was bullish gold. Yeah, so people said, come on, gold mining stocks, that's ridiculous. Now it feels that changed. We're now in this so-called public participation phase, according to the Dow theory. But it is similar with silver and with commodities at the moment. When you say, okay, I'm bullish silver, I'm bullish commodities like copper, people will ridicule you, yeah? From my point of view, in March, we saw the gold-silver ratio at basically an all-time high in history of 125. That means for 1 ounce of gold, you could get 125 ounces of silver. Now, we saw a big reversal of that ratio. And from my point of view, silver is also something like a sentiment indicator on gold. So normally, in the later stages of a bull market in gold, silver should outperform gold. So the gold-silver ratio should rise. And I think this is what's really happening now. We shouldn't underestimate that 6 out of 8 supply sources are actually in the process of stagnating. We shouldn't underestimate that industrial demand might really pick up. And now people might ask why. And I would say this is fiscal stimulus. This is all the all those infrastructure programs that will be implemented at some point will also affect silver demand. But the big driver will be investors' demand. And at some point, people say, okay, I've got gold and I'm really bullish gold, but I want a bit more oomph, a bit more beta. And then they will reconsider silver. And I think, you know, silver, but also silver miners are a great buying opportunity at the moment. We saw some large moves. Have a look at the stock prices of the large gold miners, like Barrick, for example. We saw it in Agnico. We saw it in the royalty companies. Really huge volumes kicking in. So this tells me that the generalists are coming into the market, that the mining sector is in the spotlight again. Why? Because first of all, they're making, a shitload of money, huge free cash flow generation at the moment. Their dividend policy, they are actually raising their dividends, while the Wall Street Journal just said that over the last couple of weeks, more companies completely shedded or reduced their dividends than in the total of the last 10 years.
Yeah, now, and you were talking about their expenses going down too, Ronnie.
Exactly. So then you've got the local currency factor where the Canadian dollar, the Australian dollar are pretty weak against the US dollar still, where energy prices are low. So the mining space really, they did their homework over the bear market. And I'm sure some of the companies will screw it up again in the bull market. But at the moment, I think there's really nice value that can be found in the mining space.
Okay, Ronnie, in your recent YouTube video I saw, you were talking about a few prices relative to the stock market. Gold price relative to stocks. I think you might have done silver, but also commodity prices relative to the stock market and where they've been historically and where they are right now. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, well, we, George, we really like long-term charts because our investors, they're really, you know, they don't want to make the big money in a couple of months. They're really there. They're thinking in years, in decades, even in generations. Yeah. So most of our clients are really feel more like friends and partners. So for us, it is really always important to understand the big picture. And this is why we use lots of long-term charts, but we also use lots of relative charts, so ratios. Because nowadays, you know, with extreme monetary and fiscal expansion, I think nominal prices are extremely disturbed. So I think I can get more information from relative prices. Now, if you calculate commodities versus the stock market, basically commodities are at the cheapest level since the 1960s. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that they will bottom very soon and that they will start outperforming stocks. But there is tremendous relative value there. And it also means, you know, one of the iron laws of markets is a return to the mean. And I think that we should see commodities starting to outperform the stock market at some point. As I've said before, I think that infrastructure spending might be one of the triggers for that, because let's face it, every politician will say, you know, now we have to get the economy up and we'll build roads and we'll build, new airports, bridges, whatever. So this will definitely be one driver. But on the other hand, we're seeing, because of, you know, ESG policies, which make it basically impossible for institutional investors to invest in anything that is somehow related to commodities extraction nowadays. Yeah.
Right.
It is really, from a legal point of view, it's really hard, because most asset managers say, no, we're only investing in sustainable assets. We're buying, Tesla stock, of course. Yeah. Everything that has to do with fossil energy is bad. Gold mines, really bad. Yeah. And those people probably,
I wonder what they think of my coal ETFs.
But those people have never been to a mine, yeah? I mean, I always tell my wife when we're on vacation, you know, honey, we could go there, that there is a nice mine. And she said, yeah, okay, let's do that.
Oh, I can't believe your wife doesn't want to go to the local gold mine on your vacation, Ronnie.
But the pubs are always most interesting, because this is where you get the best information. But it's interesting, you know, to get a feel for the industry and to see how alert those companies are already when it comes to environmental issues. Because, of course, I mean, if they screw it up, they will have tremendous pressure coming from capital markets. So, but it is for many investors nowadays, it's really almost impossible to invest in anything that is related to resources. Yeah, this is some very, very important point. And I think that, as I've said before, sentiment when it comes to commodities is really, really negative. Basically, nobody is bullish commodities anymore. Everybody is bullish. You know, if I would have to pitch, you know, buying Facebook or Amazon, whatever, I mean, that's the easiest sell. But from my point of view, those investments that really hurt, those investments that make you uncomfortable, where you reconsider your whole thought process back and forth, those are the best investments. While those investments where I say, okay, yeah, that's an easy one. Yeah, everybody says it's good. Those are probably the worst ones, because everything is already priced in. So I think commodities going forward might be really a good bet. It is highly contrarian, but that's what I actually like.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. All right. In the sake of time, we'll leave it there, Ronnie. It's been a fantastic interview. People are just going to love this. I really enjoyed it. So thank you very much, first and foremost. But for my viewers who want to find out more about what you do, where can they go?
Well, our company webpage is incrementum.li. We're basically offering fund management, wealth management for high net worth individuals, and we're doing quite a lot of research. Our research is published for free. You can download all our research publications. Our In Gold We Trust reports are available totally for free on ingoldwetrust.report, available in German and English and also in Mandarin. I wrote two books. One is called The Zero Interest Rate Trap and the other one, Austrian School for Investors. So I enjoy writing. Yeah, we're doing quite a lot of keynotes. They can also be found on YouTube and so on. And I'm pretty active on Twitter. And you can find me on my handle at Ron Stoefele. And George, we will practice my last name. But I have to tell you, it's not even easy for native speakers. So you did pretty well.
All right. Well, I appreciate that. Ronnie, thank you again. And I just cannot wait to do this in the future.
Thank you very much, George. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.